This is the podcast from JNS Pediatrics. Welcome to the September 6th, 2013 podcast from Journal of Neurosurgery Pediatrics. My name is Natalie Pinchem, and I will be reading synopses of some of the articles published today. Topics covered in this week's podcast are hydrocephalus, surgical technique, and epilepsy. Minimally invasive technique for insertion of ventriculopleural shunt catheters. A technical note by Marlin Dustin Richardson and Michael Handler. When a peritoneal terminus is contraindicated in cerebrospinal fluid shunting, a pleural terminus can serve as a possible site for distal shunt insertion. Numerous methods have been used to insert the distal shunt catheter into the pleural space. In this brief technical note and case series, the authors describe a minimally invasive method for insertion of distal shunt catheters into the pleural space using a split trocar. They report on its successful use in 14 procedures in 10 patients. Endoscopic treatment of quadrigeminal arachnoid cysts in children. A clinical article by Nasser El-Gandour. This study reports on 18 pediatric patients with quadrigeminal arachnoid cysts who were operated on using endoscopy. All patients had hydrocephalus. Four patients had a malfunctioning, pre-existing cystoperitoneal shunt. Endoscopic cyst fenestration was performed to allow communication between the cyst and the ventricular system and/or basal cisterns. The choice of surgical procedure depended on the presence of an adequate area of contiguity between the cyst and lateral ventricle, third ventricle, or subarachnoid cisterns. Improvement of cyst size after surgery occurred in 14 cases, whereas improvement of hydrocephalus was encountered in 16 cases. During the mean follow-up duration of 45.8 months, a repeat endoscopic procedure was performed in 7 patients, 4 patients with prior shunts and 3 patients without prior shunts. New shunt placement was required in 5 patients, 4 with prior shunts and 1 without. In conclusion, none of the patients with a prior shunt was able to become shunt independent, whereas 92.9% of patients without a prior shunt were able to avoid shunt placement. The fact that all patients who previously received a shunt required a repeat endoscopic procedure and that none of them was able to become shunt independent makes it clear that endoscopic treatment should be considered the first choice in the management of these patients. Management of subdural hygromas associated with arachnoid cysts. A clinical article by Cormac Marr and colleagues. Arachnoid cysts may occasionally be associated with subdural hygromas, but the management of these concurrent findings is controversial. The authors reviewed their experience with arachnoid cysts and identified 8 patients with intracranial arachnoid cysts and an associated subdural hygroma. Of these 8 patients, 6 presented with headaches and 4 had nausea and vomiting. 6 patients had a history of trauma. 1 patient was treated surgically at the time of initial presentation, and 7 patients were managed without surgery. All patients experienced complete resolution of their presenting signs and symptoms. The authors concluded that subdural hygroma may lead to symptomatic presentation for otherwise asymptomatic arachnoid cysts. The natural course of cyst-associated subdural hygromas, even when symptomatic, may be benign, and symptom resolution can be expected in most cases. The author suggests that symptomatic hygroma is not an absolute indication for surgical treatment, and that expectant management can result in good outcomes in many cases. Etiology associated with developing post-hemispherectomy hydrocephalus after resection disconnection procedures. A clinical article by Jennifer Fung and colleagues. Acquired hydrocephalus is a frequent problem after cerebral hemispherectomy. Previous work has shown that anatomical hemispherectomy has higher rates of postoperative hydrocephalus development than other functional disconnection operations. However, the clinical factors associated with the need for cerebrospinal fluid shunt placement after functional hemispherectomy are unknown. This study was designed to address this question of associated clinical factors in a cohort of 79, mostly pediatric patients, who underwent functional hemispherectomy at a single institution. Results showed that the underlying condition was most strongly linked with developing hydrocephalus after cerebral hemispherectomy, with 40% of patients with hemimegalencephaly developing hydrocephalus, compared to 17% of those with cortical dysplasia and Rasmussen encephalitis. Other factors, such as elevated daily temperatures, cerebrospinal fluid protein levels, and red and white blood cell counts, did not predict the need for cerebrospinal fluid shunts in multivariate analyses. These findings support the concept that hydrocephalus after cerebral hemispherectomy may be due to changes in cerebrospinal fluid bulk flow that varied by the structural changes in the remaining cortex rather than obliteration of arachnoid granulations. Furthermore, the results of this study are useful in counseling families on the probability of needing a shunt after cerebral hemispherectomy. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is contained in the American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.